Hello, this is Pandemonium 213, and I will be reading actually the first Tolkien fan fiction that I wrote in 2007. This was for the Silmarillion Writers Guild 7 and 7 project. The genesis of this story came about from an odd confluence of reading, or I should say rereading, the Silmarillion after about an 18 to 20 year hiatus from Tolkien as a whole. Shortly after, I had read an excellent biography of J. Robert Oppenheimer, popularly known as the father of the atomic bomb, and the name of that biography is American Prometheus, which I highly recommend. So, anyway, this is a story named Trinity. He lit another Pall Mall, his fourth in 50 minutes. He was nervous, to be sure, but his outer mask was calm. The serenity of a white-haired scientist sage. Fortunately, there was no one else in the green room, so he reached deep within himself and considered what Huntley might ask during the NBC white paper interview. The young blonde woman popped her head into the green room again. "Can I get you anything else, Professor Oppenheimer? You'll be on in 20 minutes." He told her he was fine, and that he was ready whenever they were. 20 minutes remained in the countdown before he offered his thoughts for posterity to Huntley and who knew how many viewers. He thought back to that day, 20 years ago, July 16, 1945. The tension during the dark hours of the night before the detonation had been hellish. Few of the scientists and engineers managed to sleep, but a chorus of sex-crazed frogs awakened those men who snapped fitfully. The amphibians croaked and copulated with lusty abandon in a small pond near the camp, oblivious to the pending event. Then the thunderstorms had rushed across the desert, unleashing their fury with lightning and 30-mile-an-hour winds, lashing out like fierce midwives as a new world readied itself to be born. The frogs, the storms, it was almost apocalyptic. On the previous day, he had inspected the gadget, an ugly metal sphere studded with detonators, perched high on its tower in the Alamogordo bombing and gunnery range. The range was in the Jornada del Muerto Valley, the journey of the dead man. The gadget should work. It must work. The countdown was imminent. General Grove stood nearby, impatient and shifting from foot to foot. The frogs were silent, and the storms had passed to the high desert. Sam Allison had called out on the loudspeaker, "It is now 0-20 minutes." Oppenheimer lay flat on the ground beside his brother Frank. They were 10,000 yards south of ground zero. 2 minutes and counting. "Lord, these affairs are hard on the heart," said to no one in particular. "Now!" At 5:30 a.m., blinding white light consumed the sky and the world changed. The fireball shifted to yellow, then red, and the sky flared in brilliant shades of violet. Searing heat and wind blasted across the flats, and the force of the explosion knocked standing observers to the ground. Man-made thunder ricocheted off the surrounding mountains. Oppenheimer saw the cloud reach high into the stratosphere, swelling into the shape of a Titan's mushroom, unearthly and majestic. It worked. They had done it. Initially, the men had been exultant. They had danced, laughed, and slapped each other on the back in giddy congratulations. He had strutted like a cowboy out of high noon. Kostowski threw his arms around him and demanded his $10, their wager that Kisti's implosion charges would work. Oppenheimer called his secretary. He asked that she pass on the message, the code for success, to his wife Kitty. Tell her she can change the sheets. Before he left the control center, he shook Kem Bainbridge's hand. The Harvard physicist looked at him in the eye and muttered, "Now we're all sons of bitches." While they drove back across the desert, back to the base camp, leaving behind his colleagues and their growing sense of sobriety, he remembered the verses of the Bhagavad Gita that had churned in his head when the fireball lifted into the atmosphere. "The radiance of 1,000 suns, the shatterer of worlds." He put himself in Prince Arjuna's place and let Krishna take care of fate, doling out who would live and who would die. Those were the things he would tell Huntly, those verses of the Bhagavad Gita. He would not tell him of the dream he had three nights after Trinity. A dream that still lingered, its images vivid, a puzzling dream engraved in his memory as if it had been real. That night he had fallen into a deep sleep, his mind and body exhausted by the days leading up to the Trinity test. His profound slumber shifted as the night drew on. He became restless as dawn approached, and then the dream took him. He found himself back at Alamogordo, the tower with the intact gadget looming in the far distance. In the middle of the sear dreamscape, between where he stood and the tower, two figures were seated at a table. He walked across the rocks and through the scrub toward them. As he approached, he could see the two figures were men, both of whom stood as he drew closer. They were lean and tall, standing at 6.5 feet or more. Their archaic clothing was peculiar, an odd hybrid of ancient Greek and medieval garb. Both had lustrous black hair that cascaded down their backs, and one man had what looked like bands of light wrapped around his ankles and connected through a pulsating beam. Shackles of light, Oppie wondered. As he drew closer, he could discern the differences in their features. One had a firm chin and stern brows. The other possessed high cheekbones and a more chiseled bone structure. But both were exceptionally attractive men, almost beautiful, really. They appeared to be clean-shaven, but upon closer examination, Oppenheimer saw that they were beardless, with no hint of shadow on their cheeks, in spite of their black hair. But their eyes startled him, most of all, and sent a shiver down his spine. The man with the heavier brows had eyes with an almost metallic sheen, reminiscent of platinum. The other man's eyes were the color of clear gray gems, but most disconcerting was that their eyes seemed to emit light. Who were these beings? Oddly, he thought of the Nephilim, the tall, beautiful fallen angels who married mortal women as written in the book of Genesis. Well, he remembered that much of the Torah. The man with the platinum eyes snorted. Oh, for God's sake, Robert, that's just superstitious nonsense. You know that as well as I do. As otherworldly as this beautiful man appeared, he sounded like he was from Manhattan, his enunciation carrying a refinement that suggested the Upper West Side, but with a touch of a Yiddish grandparent in the background. Now that was bizarre in and of itself. How in the hell did this man know what he was thinking? But this was a dream. Of course his dreaming mind was setting the scene, and it stood to reason that his mind would generate the familiar out of the unusual. Nonetheless, he felt wildly disoriented, and he stumbled as he approached the empty chair. The man with the high cheekbones was at his side in a second and steadied him. "Here, Robert, please sit down." The man spoke with an odd accent, which sounded something like an Irish brogue. In fact, as he examined the man's face again, he strongly resembled the brash young Irish physicist back at Los Alamos, the brilliant fellow who had come out of nowhere to study with Walton at Trinity College and then Dirac at Cambridge. Maybe he was black Irish? The man smiled, exposing straight white teeth, like an advertisement for toothpaste. Black Irish? Yes, close enough. He sat down at Oppenheimer's right, and the platinum-eyed man then sat at the physicist's left and scooted his chair up to the small square table. "I know you take your coffee black," said the man at his left as he poured the steaming fluid into three white ceramic cups. He handed one to Oppenheimer, who noticed that this fellow's near-perfect physicality was marred by the missing forefinger on his left hand. The nine-fingered man then produced a small pouch of tobacco and rolling papers. "And I believe this is your preferred brand of tobacco?" Oppenheimer took the cup and saucer and cautiously gulped the liquid and scalded the roof of his mouth. He set the cup down, splashing coffee on the smooth surface of the oak table. He eyed each man in turn with curiosity and not a little suspicion. "Who the hell are you?" "My apologies for the oversight," the platinum man said, extending his right hand. Oppenheimer reflexively grasped the others in a firm handshake. He was startled by the strange thrill that shot up his arm, almost like an electric shock, but not quite. It was as if his nerves sang. "I'm Saunders. Please allow me to introduce my colleague, Finn." The man with the high cheekbones and the beautiful smile likewise shook his hand, and the same peculiar yet strangely pleasant sensation shot up his right arm again. He shuddered. "Ah, you're upset. It's the clothing, isn't it?" Finn examined his tunic and leggings. "Here, Saunders, you can fix that, can't you?" "My pleasure." An opaque silver mist swirled around Finn and Saunders, obscuring them. When the mist cleared, the two men were clad in short-sleeved button-down shirts, khakis, and loafers, just like the physicists, chemists, and engineers at the labs. Their long hair, however, still flowed down their backs, and the shackles of light remained fast around Saunders' ankles. "The hair stays. We're rather vain about it, I'm afraid," said Finn. "I have no vanity regarding my chains, but they stay as well," Saunders said, his half-smile rueful. "Saunders and Finn, please call me Oppie." He deftly rolled a cigarette. Saunders produced a lighter and held it steady until the cigarette glowed red. Oppenheimer took a long drag on the cigarette and blew the smoke out of his lungs into the clear desert air. "Again, I ask, who the hell are you two? And what the hell are you two?" Saunders held his eyes fast. In spite of their otherworldly light, there was a familiarity about them. "Finn and I are your figurative forefathers, Oppie."
"Figurative?
Yes, that and probably his literal forefathers, too," Finn added. "What on earth are you fellows talking about?" This dream was all too strange. "Finn," Saunders chastised his colleague, "that is more than he can process right now." "Oh, come now, Saunders, the man's brilliant. Look at his accomplishments, his leadership. Hell, look at his goddamned eyes. Didn't you feel it when you shook his hand? He surely has the alleles, just like Jim and the others." "Don't be unfair, Finn. Look, Jim and Francis won't publish their paper for another 8 years, so let's not tease him with veiled information. This is difficult enough as it is." Saunders turned back to him. "I'm sorry, Oppie. Finn and I don't always agree on our approaches. So, as to what we are, well, we are inventors, scientists, technologists, whatever term fits. We're human, too, or at least I am in this form. We may not be exactly like you, but to a first approximation, yes, we're human." "Oh, I can see that," said Oppenheimer. "It's just your eyes. You both must have unusual refractive proteins in your irises. That threw me off." Finn beamed. "Excellent. You didn't yammer about orbs of starlight and all that gossamer fairy bullshit. That is a perfectly rational and accurate explanation. I'm telling you, Saunders, he belongs to us." "Oh, crap, Finn. Give it a rest." Saunders rolled his eyes, silver light reflecting from them. He turned his attention back to Oppenheimer. "Finn's distractions aside, we are your forefathers in the sense that in the distant past, we also created powerful artifacts, although frankly, they pale in comparison to yours. Oppie, your leadership, your accomplishments, your technology, these are nothing short of amazing. We're proud of you, but we're worried too. The reverberations of the gadget traveled farther than you realize. Much farther. That is why we are here. To warn you of the ramifications this will have on your psyche." "To warn me?" Oppenheimer narrowed his eyes as he spoke to Saunders. "Don't you think I have considered the ethics of what I have done? That my conscience has not wrestled long and hard over this? In the end, I am a scientist. I led the project. We came up with the technology. Let the politicians and the military make the decisions as to its disposition. And you think that by renouncing such decisions, you will not have blood on your hands?" Finn retorted. "You cannot shirk the responsibility for the creation of your weapon, Oppie, no matter how much you turn to Dharma and fate. You are not Prince Arjuna, and the government is not Krishna." "Finn is right. You must assume responsibility," Saunders said, his voice soft. He paused, swallowed hard, and continued. "Oppie, both Finn and I created works of great beauty, each for a different purpose. Finn tried to capture the sublime and preserve it. I wished to control others with my work. We poured our technological know-how into our craft, but ultimately, our creations caused many deaths and destruction. Yes, Finn has blood on his hands, but I have much more in my ill-conceived quest to become a god king. Hence, these shackles. My pride and folly were born of my intention, a good intention initially, to bring order to the world. Isn't that what you wish to do? Restore order to the world? To bring this terrible war to an end with your fearsome technology? Robert, I have to say that for all the horror that I inflicted on the world, the consequences of your weapon are far worse. The deaths that will result in the detonations in Japan and the potential for more death, even the extinction of mankind. What you and your men have unleashed is beyond my comprehension. Oppenheimer buried his face in his hands. He knew. The targets had been selected. Next month, the applications of theory would explode over a far land. Saunders and Finn each put a hand on his shoulders, and a comforting warmth radiated into him, but their eyes glittered as he looked up at them, his vision distorted by tears. "I'm sorry, Oppie," Finn said, his smooth voice now husky. "It will be hard to bear. Do not regret what you have done. It may be that you and your men will save lives by taking others, but you must accept responsibility in the end. And know this, you will be punished. And not only by self-inflicted guilt, others will punish you. The three of us here, we all started with good intentions, but the outcomes can be dark. It's a Faustian bargain." Saunders looked at him, his eyes sad and haunted, their silver light dimmed. "You are both the creator and the destroyer, Robert. Brahma and Shiva. Now be Vishnu, the preserver. Be wise and be careful. And stop smoking those damn things," Finn scolded. "You're killing yourself with them." "Sound advice," Saunders smiled, his mood lightening, as he pushed back his chair and stood with Finn following suit. "Well, Oppie, it has been a pleasure. Saunders and I must take our leave." Oppenheimer stood and pulled at the rim of his pork pie hat. "Likewise, it has been an interesting dream, worthy of psychoanalysis, I'd think, but with all your obscure remarks and blunt ones, too. Who would have guessed that fellows like you lurked in my subconscious?" Finn laughed. "Stay away from the Freudians, Oppie. Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar." He stepped forward and embraced Oppenheimer, patted him on the back, and then released him to be hugged in a similar avuncular fashion by Saunders. Again, as he was enveloped in these tall men's arms, the electric sensation coursed through him as if his body recognized something familiar in these truly strange beings. Oppenheimer took a final drag on the cigarette. "Before you go, you say you are scientists and inventors. What did you make?" Finn and Saunders looked at one another for a long moment. Finn reached deep into his pockets and pulled out three jewels, which he held in his cupped hands. The jewels blazed with internal fire, their gold, silver, and white light scintillating together in a bizarre rhythmic pattern. Oppenheimer squinted at the nearly blinding light. What were the materials used to construct these? And what was the nature of the reactions that produced the emission of the light? Finn smiled knowingly as if he guessed his thoughts. "I can't tell you how much I'd like to discuss that with you, Oppie, but I'm afraid it is not allowed." Saunders slowly reached into the left pocket of his khakis and pulled out a simple gold ring. He closed his hand around it briefly and then opened his fingers, the space of his missing digit all the more jarring against the beauty of the artifact. The ring shone with a golden light that glowed from graceful foreign script engraved in the metal. Saunders and Finn held the jewels in the ring close to one another, each man engrossed in the sight of his creation. Then both men raised their eyes to meet his stare. Oppenheimer realized that if the ethereal light was taken away, Ben and Saunders' eyes resembled his own with their clarity, their intensity, and their immense sorrow. "Goodbye, Oppie," Ben said, his voice etched with sadness and regret. "Goodbye, Finn, Saunders." "Farewell, Robert," said Saunders. "The three of us, Now we're all sons of bitches. With that, Finn and Saunders simultaneously tossed the jewels in the ring high into the air, where they swirled around each other until they could no longer be seen. Then the sky exploded with the radiance of 1,000 suns. His heart raced as he recalled the dream. As always, he was exhilarated, confused, and frightened upon its recollection. He remembered that his upper palate was painful the morning after the dream, burned from the hot black coffee. He remembered that day in 1953 when he read the news. The structure of DNA had been solved, and the code of the secret of light was cracked. He walked from the Institute of Advanced Study over to the university campus, where he went to the library and found the copy of Nature. Watson and Crick, Jim and Francis. How had Finn and Saunders, figments of his subconscious mind, known about them? Later, he saw the photo of Jim Watson. Those brilliant eyes, intense, vastly intelligent, so similar to his own, and lack of refractive proteins notwithstanding, so much like Finn and Saunders' eyes. He had written a note to Watson, leaving the small stamped envelope unsealed since he knew the agents would read it. He asked Watson for a reprint. Within 2 weeks, the big envelope, its seal broken by Strauss's goons, arrived at Alden Manor. Watson had expressed his admiration for Oppenheimer as written on the front of the reprint, stating that he was honored by the request from one of America's greatest scientists. Oppenheimer had paged through the reprint in the warm sun, its light filtering through the leafy trees that lined the Princeton street. He examined the model of the double helix. Beautiful and elegant. What would be the consequences of Watson and Crick's discovery? Would it revolutionize the world like the detonations in 1945? Jim Watson was his brother in science, and possibly, if he were to put any credence in a dream's intimation, his very distant cousin, linked through eldritch genes embedded in the helices that coiled within their respective cells. Did they share an improbable common inheritance from those two men who came from another time, from an elusive history? He read Watson's note again and traced the script with his fingers. A chill ran up his arms as his nerves sang in recognition. The blonde girl stuck her head in the room again. "Professor Oppenheimer, this is the 2-minute warning." "Thank you, I am ready." 140,000 dead in Hiroshima, 74,000 in Nagasaki. Missiles with nuclear warheads in the Soviet Union and the United States aimed at one another, bristling atomic sabers ready to carry death across the continents. 3 jewels and a golden ring ignited the sky. "You are Brahma and Shiva, be Vishnu." He had no regrets. He had done the right thing, but he bore the responsibility. And he had been punished. The camera was rolling, but he couldn't bring himself to look directly at it. He kept his eyes lowered for the most part as he spoke of that early morning in mid-July 20 years ago. We knew the world would not be the same. A few people laughed. A few people cried. Most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, he takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose we all thought that, one way or another. So, a few endnotes here. My primary resources for the story were American Prometheus, The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer by Kay Bird and Martin Sherwin. This is really an authoritative biography of Oppenheimer, and the scene of the Morning of Trinity was derived from this book. The other resource was The Gita of J. Robert Oppenheimer by James Hygieia. It's from the Proceedings of the American Philosophical Society, Volume 144, published in June 2000. And it's a scholarly paper that examines Oppenheimer's embrace of the Bhagavad Gita. And Oppenheimer even learned Sanskrit so he could read the original text. John Donne's poems also influenced Oppenheimer, and it is believed that he chose the code name Trinity based on one of three D of Donne's works. The lines from one, a litany, are quoted actually in my written piece of Trinity. So I really think Oppenheimer is one of the most tragic figures in American science. He was a brilliant man. He was a polymath who excelled in many disciplines, and he had leftist leanings, which reflected the conscience of a thoughtful, enlightened man. And although he was never a member of the Communist Party, his avid support of the same in San Francisco added fuel to the Red Scare witch hunt in the mid-1950s. Louis Strauss, who's mentioned in the story, led the investigation against Oppenheimer and ultimately humiliated the physicist and stripped him of his security clearance. Oppenheimer was eventually exonerated by President John A. Kennedy and honored by President Johnson. And Finn's words of that he should stop smoking were prophetic, as Oppenheimer died in 1967 at age 62 of throat cancer. One relevant quote from Tolkien regarding the atomic bomb comes from his letter to his son Christopher Tolkien, dated the 9th of August 1945, so shortly, after the explosions in over Japan. The news today about atomic bombs is so horrifying, one is stunned. The utter folly of these lunatic physicists to consent to do such work for war purposes, calmly plotting the destruction of the world. Such explosives in men's hands, while their moral and intellectual status is declining, is about as useful as giving out firearms to all inmates of a jail and saying that you hope this will ensure peace. But one good thing may arise out of it, I suppose, if the write-ups are not overheated. Japan ought to cave in. Well, we're in God's hands, but he does not look kindly on Babel builders. So clearly, Tolkien was quite opinionated about it, but like many, he justified this technology by the means of ending a war. So there are no easy answers here. So also I should note that the interaction between Jim Watson and Oppenheimer in the story is purely fictional, but I think it's a pretty safe bet that Watson and Oppenheimer were well aware of one another's accomplishments. I'll also note that Watson is a prime example of a scientist who made a pivotal discovery along with Crick, Rosalind Franklin, and Wilkins that changed our world. But Watson is highly subject to moral fallibility, and examples of sexism and racism in his comments abound. So we're all human and with feet of clay, even though we may come up with technology that may seem magical and horrifying in its power.
I'd also like to add that the soundtrack used throughout is from the symphonic version of the Doctor Atomic Opera by John Adams, and it's conducted by David Robertson and the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. Thank you.